This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
I'm Alex Smith. In this week's program, three deep green activists ask and answer the perennial question, what are we supposed to do in a world hell-bent on destroying nature? Please don't assume I agree with everything that is said. This discussion from a web chat hosted by Eric Hoffner of Orion Magazine made me think hard. It uncovered both dark and light hidden in our daily worries. Let it work on you. Here is Eric Hoffner to introduce his guests.
Welcome to Orion Magazine's discussion of Confessions of a Recovering Environmentalist with Paul Kingsnorth, Leira Keith, and David Abram. Thanks for joining us. This is Eric Hoffner, Outreach Coordinator for Orion. Paul Kingsnorth, he's been writing about environmental issues for 15 years and is a former deputy editor of the renowned UK publication, The Ecologist. In 2009, he co-founded the Dark Mountain Project, a cultural and creative response to this age of ecocide, as he calls it. He lives in Cumbria in northern England. Leira Keith is a writer, small farmer, and radical feminist activist. She's the author of two novels, as well as The Vegetarian Myth, Food Justice and Sustainability. And she's co-author with Derek Jensen and Eric McBay of Deep Green Resistance, Strategy to Save the Planet. And David Abram, he's a cultural ecologist and philosopher who lectures and teaches widely. He's the author most recently of Becoming Animal, An Earthly Cosmology, as well as The Spell of the Sensuous. David's writings have received various honors and awards, including the Lannan Literary Award, and he lives with his two children in the foothills of the Southern Rockies. So, Paul, your story in the current issue of Orion, Confessions of a Recovering Environmentalist, has received a lot of attention and stirred a lively debate in the forum attached to it at our site. Would you mind starting our discussion of it today with a short reading from the piece and then sharing your further thoughts?
Yes, I will. Thank you, Eric, and thanks for inviting me onto this call. It's a great thing to be doing. There's been a great discussion around this piece, so I'm really glad to be able to continue it here. Yeah, let me just start then by reading a few paragraphs from the article, which I hope sum up some of the key points. I became an environmentalist because of a strong emotional reaction to wild places and the other than human world, to beech trees and hedgerows and pounding waterfalls, to songbirds and sunsets, to the flying fish in the Java Sea and the canopy of the rainforest at dusk when the gibbons come to the waterside to feed. From that reaction came a feeling, which became a series of thoughts, that such things are precious for their own sake, that they are food for the human soul, and that they need people to speak for them to and defend them from other people because they cannot speak our language and we have forgotten how to speak theirs, and because we are killing them to feed ourselves, and we know it and we care about it sometimes, but we do it anyway because we're hungry or we've persuaded ourselves that we are. But these are not, I think, very common views today. Today's environmentalism is as much a victim of the contemporary cult of utility as every other aspect of our lives, from science to education. We are not environmentalists now because we have an emotional reaction to the wild world. Most of us wouldn't even know where to find it. We're environmentalists now in order to promote something called sustainability. What does this curious plastic word mean? It does not mean defending the non-human world from the ever-expanding empire of Homo sapiens sapiens, though some of its adherents like to pretend it does, even to themselves. It means sustaining human civilization at the comfort level that the world's rich people, us, feel is their right, without destroying the natural capital or the resource base that is needed to do so. It is, in other words, an entirely human-centered piece of politicking disguised as concern for the planet. In a very short time, just over a decade, this worldview has become all-pervasive. It's voiced by the President of the USA and the President of Anglo-Dutch Shell, and many people in between. The success of environmentalism has been total at the price of its soul. The environment is the victim of the human empire, but the environment, that distancing word, that empty concept, does not exist. It is the air, the waters, the creatures we make homeless or lifeless in flocks and legions, and it is us too. We are it, we are in it and of it, we make it and live it, We are fruit and soil and tree, and the things done to the roots and the leaves come back to us. We make ourselves slaves to make ourselves free, and when the shackles start to rub, we confidently predict the emergence of new, more comfortable designs. I don't have any answers. If by answers we mean political systems, better machines, means of engineering some grand shift in consciousness. All I have is a personal conviction built on those feelings, those responses, that goes back to the moors of northern England and the rivers of southern Borneo, that something big is being missed, that we are both hollow men and stuffed men, and that we will keep stuffing ourselves until the food runs out. And if outside the dining room door we have made a wasteland and called it necessity, then at least we will know we are not to blame, because we are never to blame, because we are the humans. So that's a couple of paragraphs from what is a very long piece, and quite a divisive piece, I think, and I think deliberately so as well. This is an essay that I wrote after about 15 years of being an environmental activist, being an activist on the front lines, also working for NGOs, writing about green issues, trying to think this stuff through, and seeing the green movement change in that time, and also coming to the conclusion, and it was a very difficult conclusion to admit to myself, but I think a lot of people are starting to admit it to themselves now, coming to the conclusion that a lot of the problems that we're facing can't be solved in the sense that we would like to solve them. For example, we're not going to stop climate changing. We're not going to stop the mass extinction event that we're in at the moment. Hopefully we can prevent it from getting any worse than it has to get, but we're in it and it's happening and it's too late to do a lot of things about it. And meanwhile, the green movement, which I suppose sprang to life in the 60s as a very radical challenge to the industrial system, and which presented a very different way of looking at the world, the most radical new idea, I suppose, for hundreds of years, really, more radical than anything Marx came up with, in my view, is this thing that we might call ecocentrism, which is that our value systems should encompass the world beyond the human. They should encompass life itself, rather than simply the interest of those of our species. It's a very difficult thing to put into practice, but it is a very good thing to aim for. And that was what the environment movement was aiming for when it came into being. And it was also aiming to really wind back much of the damage done by the industrial system. But over the last 30 or 40 years, environmentalism has been probably inevitably sucked into that system. And two things, briefly, two things in particular, I think, have happened that have bothered me, and I think which have really neutered the radical challenge of environmentalism. Firstly, it's been sucked in by the market. And if you listen to a lot of environmentalists now in the mainstream, and obviously I'm generalizing here in this essay and in this call, when I talk about environmentalism, I'm really talking about the kind of popular environmentalism that you'll hear from the NGOs and the green parties and the media figures and the people who have influence in government and business. But, you know, environmentalism has become a market now. It's become a carbon market. It's become a technological way to make a huge amount of money trying to stop climate change or invent new trees that will suck the carbon from the air and put the wind farms all over the mountains and all the rest of it. And that has become what we call sustainability, which again was originally a radical word and has now become a word which seems to mean sustaining industrial civilization through the use of technologies which don't emit carbon, and is no kind of radical challenge at all. So that's the first problem. The second one, I think, is that the Greens have allowed themselves to be identified with the political left far too much. And the political left's job, its historic challenge, is human equality and the fair distribution of resources. And my point is not that those are bad things, but that they're very different things from the original Green idea of bringing about a challenge that looks more widely than simply at human interest. And because the Greens have allowed themselves to be dominated by the left, if you like, I find that the original ecocentric narrative, the beyond human narrative, has almost completely disappeared. And what we end up with, again, as I say, in the mainstream, is a kind of bleached out environmentalism, which isn't really much of a challenge to anything. And the biggest symbol of this for me, and it's the thing that kind of broke me, I suppose, with that movement, was the kind of attack on wildness and the attack on open lands that's going on now in the name of environmentalism. I mean, I live in the northwest of England, and I spent a lot of my childhood, as I say in the article, on the mountains and on the moors and on the hills, and it's those places that I learned to have experiences with the non-human world, with nature as a whole, with wildness that made me want to protect it. And I see those places now being covered in 500-foot wind turbines and tarmac access roads and pylons and all the rest of it. And I see the seas covered with the same things. And I see people that I thought were on my side arguing for the barraging of estuaries and the covering of open spaces with these huge solar panels and all the rest of it. And the end result of this, as far as I can see, is that we're destroying the environment in order to save the environment. And what it actually comes down to, I think, is because environmentalism has changed in that way, we've allowed ourselves to become a movement of people who cannot see the wood for the trees, almost sometimes quite literally. And I think we're in a period now, a historical period perhaps, where it's impossible to pretend any longer that we're not undergoing a collapse, an environmental collapse, but also a collapse of our assumptions and maybe our industrial system. And it's at this point where it's more important than ever for us to assert those original radical green values. And I don't see that happening across the mainstream of the green movement. So that, I guess, is the case I'm making here.
Thanks, Paul. Eric from Orion Magazine here again. Now, Liera, Keith, would you reflect on the article and relate Paul's thoughts to your own work and your own writings?
First, I want to say that Paul's essay was one of the most beautiful things I've read in a long time, and I just wish that beauty was enough to save our planet. So 200 species are going to go extinct today, and another 200 will go extinct tomorrow, and then another 200 will go extinct the day after that, and they were my kin. And I am bewildered that environmentalists are no longer telling the truth. So I'm going to quote Paul here. Today's environmentalism is about saving civilization from the results of its own actions. Now, this is not cognitively challenging. There is a political arrangement that's created that feeding frenzy of destruction. And yes, it's called civilization. So the obvious question, well, what is civilization? Well, it just means people living in cities. And what that means is that they need more than the land can give. Okay, they're living in too dense of a population. A great example, of course, would be Manhattan. If you think of that little tiny island, there's no way that's going to support 2 million people. So the food, the water, the energy, they all have to come from somewhere else because the city has used up its own. So from that point forward, it doesn't actually matter what lovely, peaceful, nonviolent values people might hold in their hearts. That society is now dependent on imperialism and genocide because no one willingly gives up their land, their water, their trees. But since the city has used up its own, it has to go out and get those from somewhere else. And that's the last 10,000 years in two sentences. So here's the situation. 98% of the planet's old-growth forests are gone. 99% of the world's prairies are gone. They're simply gone. They've been eradicated. And that is the predictable endpoint of civilization, of human societies that take more than the land can give. They survive by devouring land bases. Civilization is incompatible with life. And we need to say that basic fact as loud as we can, as often as we can. It was a one-time blowout, and it's over, because the planet is now on the verge of complete biotic collapse. We can't have our planet and eat it too. I shouldn't have to say that. It should be obvious at this late stage of the game. But this is a culture of profound entitlement, and it's so profound it doesn't even notice that it's turning the planet to dust. So for the Earth to survive, that living arrangement called civilization, it's going to have to be stopped. And we're going to have to stop that destruction. So all of it, the oil, the coal, the clear cuts, the dams, the entire industrial economy. Now, this could be done using nonviolent direct action, but it would require sustained committed blockades, not symbolic blockades, not those blockades that make a point for a day, but blockades that make a decisive material impact. Okay, we stop the trains carrying the coal, and we can stop the tankers carrying the oil and the pipelines carrying the tar sands. If we love this planet, we stop them. And we also stop telling ourselves fairy tales about wind turbines and solar panels. And if you don't believe me, Google right now. Google rare earth mining and look at the pictures. It's every bit as horrifying as the tar sands and mountaintop removal. Now, as an example, I'd really like to reference the French labor strike that happened in 2010. The protesters blockaded the fuel depots, the oil refineries, and the major oil terminal in France. So in 3 weeks, the whole economy was slowing to a halt for lack of fuel. And the French strikers did what every military and every insurgency does. They interrupted the keynotes of infrastructure. And in this case, it was the energy infrastructure. They were well on their way to shutting down the entire economy. And they did it using nonviolence. So this could be done. The real question is, why aren't we doing it? And I hate that part of the answer is that we're the people who benefit from this repulsive arrangement of power. But some of us intend to start. And you can find out more about the Deep Green Resistance Movement at deepgreenresistance.org at our website. There's also a group called MEND that we could reference, and that's the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta. The people on the land of the Niger Delta have been devastated by the oil industry, just devastated. And they originally tried nonviolent civil disobedience, and they were all killed by the military. So they moved, they stepped up and they now do direct actions against the infrastructure itself. And they've been incredibly successful. They've reduced the oil output of Nigeria by a full third, and there's just a few hundred of them, and that's how successful they've been. So, yes, this can be done. We could stop this economy. So this is the fact that they stand. You know, our planet is actually dying, and she's really being drawn and quartered. You know, there are parts of China right now in which there are no longer any flowering plants, and that's because all the pollinators are dead. But that's 500 million years of evolution that's gone. So that's a complete biotic collapse. We've got to start thinking like a serious resistance movement, because this is a war. I know it feels like daily life because it's been going on for 10,000 years, and the cupboards are full and the lights are on, but this is a war. And honestly, if we were polar bears or black terms, we would know it was a war. So here's a thought experiment. If like evil Nazis had taken over our country and they were destroying the forests and the rivers and they were wiping out 200 species every day and altering the climate itself, I think we would know it was time to fight back. I don't know why ExxonMobil and Monsanto and Cargill get a free pass here. I do know that we need a movement that's brave and smart and militant and means it, because we need warriors who will put themselves between what is left of this planet and fossil fuel. And if you can't be one of those warriors, it's fine. You can be part of the culture of resistance, because resistance movements always need two things. They need loyalty, they need material support, and all of us can do that. If anyone is left to look back 100 years from now, they are going to wonder what was wrong with us that we didn't fight back when our planet was going down. Now, you love something or you wouldn't be listening today. Whatever you love, it is under assault. And love is a verb, which means we've got to let that love call us to action.
Thanks, Liara.
This is Radio EcoShock. This week we are playing Confessions of a Recovering Environmentalist, a three-way discussion organized by Orion Magazine's Eric Hoffner.
Now, David Abram, are you there? Now, David, you're a deep thinker on these issues. What rang true for you in Paul's piece and in Liara's remarks?
Oh, lots and lots. It's a great essay. Pretty incisive in many of its facets. I've never been very at ease or at home with the term environmentalist or even the word environment, since it takes all that multiplicitous weirdness and otherness from spiders to thunderclouds and flattens it all into one thing, the environment, which sets it all in relation to us. The environment means our environment. It overlooks that we're the environment for the tree frogs. So in some ways, the problem is set by the term and by the way we understand the very notion of environment. Paul speaks of non-human nature other than human nature. But the wild world that each of us is concerned to protect is not the non-human or the other than human. It's a much more than human world. It's a world that includes us two-legged, but it also exceeds us. And it's the way that it exceeds us that's so necessary. I'm really grateful to this essay for calling us back to that emotional attachment and the sense, Paul's sense of radical astonishment and wonder that we all know, you know, that feeling full passion at finding ourselves inside this outrageously weird and beautiful world in all its multiplicity and bizarreness. Beauty, deep beauty, yeah, the sense of wonder and the fierce love that such beauty inspires. When we trivialize people's sensory attachment to the beauty of their place, to the beauty of the land wherever they live, if we trivialize that or say, well, that's got to be secondary because we need to put a wind farm here, we need to at least be aware that that is undermining people's deepest sense of solidarity with the rest of the earth. Sensory perception is like the glue that binds our separate nervous systems into the encompassing ecosystem. I think Paul's essay brings that out. It also points to how the wind was taken out of the sails of the radical ecology movement precisely at the moment when the computer moved into people's homes and the digital revolution became this much more collective and personalized thing infiltrating our homes, our pockets, our telephones, and everybody fell into this deep thrall with their screens and began to live much, much more in this house of mirrors that isolates us or sort of closes us into a loop with our own signs, just sort of short-circuiting the old and instinctive reciprocity between the human body and the animate earth. And Paul's critique of the abstraction and abstractness of the movement today and the way it really is just a continuation of business as usual. How do we preserve or find some way to, you know, keep this civilization rolling? There's so much that's destructive and disastrous about this civilization. Why should we be concerned to keep culture in this form going? What other possibilities are there for culture? But given all of this incisiveness, for me, the essay's power is blunted when, Paul, when you lambast or ridicule the notion that social justice and environmental justice should go hand in hand. I mean, I think they better go hand in hand. Otherwise, there ain't much hope, not just for us humans, but for most other species as well. We just need a much more alive and vitalizing sense of what social justice or societal well-being might look like. What sort of culture is appropriate to a wild biosphere? What does wild culture look like, taste like? What does it feel like? What kind of culture would be appropriate to the high desert where I'm living now? What other very different styles of culture are commensurate with a wild, flourishing coastal estuary or with a healthy and exuberant rainforest? What does wild culture look like? So that's a key question. And, you know, in response also to what Lierre is so eloquently saying, but my sense is that bringing civilization down by confrontational means, yes, by violent means, I don't know. My sense is that the other side has all the weapons. It's got all the ways and means to just, I can't imagine a more faster, swifter way to bring on a police state reaction than being as full-on confrontational as we could be. So I'm in deep solidarity with my brother and sister in this conversation, but I'm interested more in how we transform or shapeshift or metamorphose this culture. And I think there's lots of possibilities for that to happen because it's just being shoved. It's a necessity that is beginning to bite at the heels and at the noses of every single one of us now.
Thank you, David. Now, Paul or Lierre, you want to reflect on any of what's been said to date?
Yeah, I'd like to say a couple of things if I could. I thought both of you are saying necessary and powerful things. The one thing I would clear up quickly is the point about environmental justice and social justice. I'm not saying they shouldn't go hand in hand. The point I was making is that I constantly hear this quote from environmentalists that they are the same thing. It's the kind of left-green, it's the sort of left-green standard. You know, they're the same thing. And the point is that they could be the same thing and they should be the same thing, but usually they're not.
Right.
And I think it's a kind of excuse that you hear from the sort of the eco left, if you like, very often, is that campaigning for, so we have to have all the, we have, basically it's almost as if we have to do the social justice stuff first because otherwise we can't do the other stuff. And I think, but I mean, I'm not suggesting it doesn't matter. It does matter. And I think if you have if you have any kind of horribly unjust world, as we're starting to see now, then it comes apart at the seams anyway, because eventually people take it apart, especially when the resources start running out. I get very conflicted about the what to do question, which of course will come up a lot, I'm sure, fairly soon about this. I kind of share all of Lierre's feelings about it, but I also share David's reservations because I just think that there's a novel called Ridley Walker, written by a writer called Russell Hoban, who died recently. Fantastic novel, very strange, written in an odd dialect, which is supposed to be a sort of bastardized version of English. And it's set 1,000 years after a nuclear holocaust in Kent, in England. Brilliant book. I really recommend it. And it's a post-apocalyptic book. It was written about 25 years ago now. And the plot, without giving too much away, revolves around this strange community of people who've almost forgotten everything about civilization except the power to violence that it had. And they spend most of the book looking for something that they vaguely remember in legends. What they're actually looking for is the power to make weapons again. But what they're really looking for, more metaphorically, is the power to rebuild this enormous thing that collapsed, because they have the vague stories about how wonderful it was. And the fear I have is that if the whole thing does collapse swiftly, whether we do it or whether it's done, if we haven't stopped believing in it, we'll try and build it up again. You know what I mean? And that's the problem. And what I can see at the moment, the one thing that does give me some sense of optimism is that this system is cracking so fast now, and so many people are losing faith in it and beginning to see it for what it is. And that doesn't mean they know what the hell to do or whether they can do anything. But, I mean, you can see it in every corner of the world, in all sorts of reflections. And the more that happens, the more we lose faith, the easier it is to do something, whatever the something is. We have to lose faith in it first. We have to see it not working. And it's interesting. I completely share Lier's sense of outrage, which is, why the hell aren't people seeing this? Why aren't they doing anything? Can you not, you know, look at the figures, look out your window. You can see this stuff. Why aren't you doing it? But the answer is, of course, that we're comfortable. And those of us who aren't comfortable have the promise that they could be comfortable if they join in. And that's so powerful. That it's very hard to defeat it. So the only conclusion I've come to really on this stuff at the moment is that if we can stop feeling comfortable with this, it could fall apart quite quickly, because I think a lot of people know how poisonous it is, but they don't know what to do.
Lier, do you have anything to interject?
Yeah, the whole thing is a pyramid scheme, and it's been that way for the last 10,000 years. And the planet is being gutted for a tiny percentage of us, and that includes other lands and other peoples. And we can leave them to fight on the front lines while we keep getting all the goodies, or you know, we can say out loud that the poor people are fighting and people of color are fighting and indigenous people are fighting because they're the ones on the front lines. It's their land right now that's being destroyed, so that we can have things like iPhones and, you know, ice cream 24/7 or whatever the hell. And it's just not acceptable to me to let the people of Mend be the only ones who fight, you know, because they're the ones that are knee-deep in oil sludge when all that's being done for our benefit. And yes, people are very attached to this way of life if they're rich people. I think that the poor, which is most of the people around, heave a huge sigh of relief if this ended tomorrow. And they would very much like to go back to the life ways that they've known for thousands of years, all of which has been taken from them, so that, you know, we can have. And, you know, we essentially live behind a military barricade. That's what makes that possible. So we can pretend we live these nice nonviolent lives and aren't we all peaceful and friendly. But in fact, you know, in our name and for our benefit, the planet is being gutted. So I can't back away from the necessity for some of us at least to join in solidarity and fight for our planet, and also to fight for, you know, the human justice that would ultimately come with that.
Eric from Orion Magazine here again. This event today is free and open to all, and we hope you'll consider supporting it and others in the series by making a gift to Orion, which you can do at orionmagazine.org/donate. Now, we do have a lot of questions coming in. Let's start with Clark. Clark sent a great email that had a letter to the editor of his local paper attached. This letter was signed by 19 sustainability and community groups urging the new mayor of his city to take that city to the next level, they said, with a vision of sustainability and greenness. Yet, he said, nowhere is there any mention of protecting parks or green spaces or rivers or other critical elements. So he wants to know, what can recovering environmentalists do to balance or counter this seemingly inexorable push for sustainability to the exclusion of almost everything else, including saving our remaining nature and wildlands?
When we come back, Radio EcoShock will continue with Confessions of a Recovering Environmentalist, courtesy of Orion Magazine.